From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin may not be very popular in the West these days, but his ratings are high in the motherland.
But first, President Obama has officially named his new nominee to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Matthews Burwell. She's currently the head of the White House Office of Management and Budget, and she's being nominated to replace Kathleen Sebelius, who is resigning. If confirmed by the Senate, Burwell would be at the heart of one of the most bitter political issues in Washington, the Affordable Care Act. And today's announcement at the White House doesn't come in a vacuum. It comes at the end of a week when it became clear that we are really getting into election season ahead of the midterm elections this fall. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. He's with us now from Washington. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, so Republican Senator Mitch McConnell is welcoming the resignation of Kathleen Sebelius. John McCain is praising the nominee to replace her. Is the White House hoping for a reset on health care with Republicans here?
They know better than that. And some of the Republican praise has been backhanded at best. They've been praising Kathleen Sebelius, for instance, for managing something they say was unmanageable and that no one could have done a better job with. I think from the White House perspective, if they were going to try to have Kathleen Sebelius out of that job before the election, this was the moment for two reasons. One is we just got some enrollment figures, 7.5 million people on the exchange. That's more than initial estimates. That is an opportunity to at least turn it into a political winner. And second, if they are going to get a new nominee confirmed by the Senate, it better happen this year. There's a decent chance that Democrats lose control of the Senate at the end of the year, and good luck getting the Republicans to go with a nominee for the HHS secretary under President Obama's White House.
Well, what about Sylvia Matthews Burwell? Tell us more about her and her chances of getting confirmed by the Senate.
A Rhodes Scholar originally from West Virginia. She's been leading the Office of Management and Budget, which is kind of a dry bureaucratic world, but it's a world that has a lot of interactions with Congress. She had to manage the government shutdown. She has to deal with members of Congress and their complaints and their concerns all the time. It's been a time where the budget, it's not like it's under control, but the deficit has been reduced somewhat, and there's a lot of high grades for her leadership and her management inside the White House. She also has a long history in the philanthropic and private sector, working for the Gates Foundation, worked in the Clinton White House as well. Kind of a consummate inside player, a generation younger also than Kathleen Sebelius, which may help her in terms of management of a website that still isn't a done deal and still has to perform for a new set of enrollments this fall.
Somebody with political experience, it reminds you of what happened when Jack Lew took over at Treasury, taking over for Timothy Geithner. The White House was saying, we need somebody who can work with Congress. The most important thing right now is somebody who can really get things done on Capitol Hill.
That's right. Look, the White House knows that Republicans aren't suddenly going to like the health care law because they like any better the HHS secretary. But they do know that they just got her confirmed unanimously at OMB a little more than a year ago. And they do know that this will be a tougher transition and a tougher confirmation fight. But in the context of what you know you have to – the fights you have to pick in Washington, it was a good opportunity to get some new leadership in there, to know that this is going to be an ongoing challenge. It's not just HHS. It's a huge – not just the health care law. HHS is a huge agency with big repercussions throughout the government, and she is someone, obviously, who knows the subject matter better than just about anyone.
Meanwhile, as we said, this came at the end of a week where it really became clear that we're starting to get into an election season here. There have been some sharp political exchanges on Capitol Hill. I want to listen to one between Secretary of State John Kerry and Senator John McCain, who said the Obama administration was, quote, failing very badly in a number of international crises. Let's listen.
On the issue of Ukraine, my hero, Teddy Roosevelt, used to say, talk softly but carry a big stick. What you're doing is talking strongly and carrying a very small stick, in fact, a twig.
And this is how John Kerry responded.
But your friend Teddy Roosevelt also said that the credit belongs to the people who are in the arena who are trying to get things done. And we're trying to get something done.
Is that going to be an issue in the elections this year, foreign policy, do you think?
I think it's a pretty neat encapsulation of the way that John Kerry has handled that job, trying to get things done. And I wonder how much it would be an issue with Russia in the news recently, if it becomes more of one. Certainly Iran and Syria and North Korea and other challenges give it the opportunity to rear its head. Traditionally, midterm elections in particular don't turn on foreign policy, but there are so many hotspots out there and so many different lines in the water that Secretary of State Kerry has thrown that there's the potential for any one of them to come up. And you hear Senator McCain's critique, kind of broad critique, critique, saying you're not getting anything done when you're trying to get everything done.
Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas and Attorney General Eric Holder got into a heated exchange of their own. Gohmert was asking Holder's office to release more documents, and he brought up the fact that the House Oversight Committee had voted to hold Holder in contempt of Congress for not releasing documents related to Operation Fast and Furious. Let's listen.
And I realize that contempt is not a big deal to our attorney general, but it is important that we have proper oversight.
You don't want to go there, okay?
I don't want to go there?
No.
About the contempt?
You should not assume that that is not a big deal to me. I think that it was an...
Rick Klein, pretty sharp exchanges there. What's going on?
Pretty extraordinary. And then Attorney General Holder followed up with a speech the next day where he said that the scrutiny that he and President Obama have gotten has been unprecedented and unwarranted and ugly. It happened to be a speech before Al Sharpton's group in New York City. So that led a lot of people to suggest that he was saying because of his race and President Obama's race, they were being targeted. So a new conversation, a new set of tensions, and one revolving around race, then something we haven't seen before.
Okay, Rick, one word answers here. What do the Democrats want this election to be about?
They want this election to be about progress, moving in the right direction.
And Republicans?
Healthcare, Obamacare, namely.
Rick Klein, political director of ABC News. Thanks, as always, Rick.
Thank you.
Even before the recent events in Ukraine, Vladimir Putin was being viewed with increasing suspicion in the West for his authoritarian style of government. Russia's annexation of the Crimea has done further damage to his reputation in Europe and the U.S., but not in Russia. Surveys show that Putin's popularity at home has risen sharply. To gauge public opinion, the BBC's Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg went to the village of Chaikoskova, about 60 miles from Moscow.
In the village of Chaikoskova, the Collective Farm Veterans Choir is getting ready to rehearse. Through the window, I can see an unseasonal blizzard is transforming potholed roads and dilapidated tenements into something almost magical. Under its blanket of spring snow, this village could be the setting for a Russian fairy tale. So perhaps it's not surprising that it was in a house just up the road from here that Tchaikovsky wrote The Nutcracker. When the choir bursts into song, the song itself is about the horrors of war, about bullets whistling past, a Cossack hero gunned down in battle. The Russian psyche has been scarred by a century of conflict, civil war, world war, and Cold War. In between songs, I get chatting to the seven singers. I tell them that after Russia's annexation of the Crimea, there are some people in Europe and America who see the Kremlin as a threat to world peace. Well, I say, well done, Putin, Svetlana replies. We're pleased to have such a leader. With what he did in Crimea, Putin showed that Russia isn't a country you can push around or pressure or scare into submission. Across the road is the Collective Farms dairy factory, with its large vats of cottage cheese and butter and thick, creamy yogurt. The deputy director, Vladimir, admits he's wary of the West. I think that America is like a dog with rabies, Vladimir tells me. In Russia, we're not sure if it's going to bite us or not. We'll keep our distance and make sure we've got a gun ready, just in case. I visit the village beauty salon, where stylist Olga is mixing up some hair colouring for her next customer. I ask her how worried she is by Western sanctions against Russia. I'm not worried at all, Olga says. Even if the rest of the world were to close their borders to us, Russia is so big, we'll always find places where we can go on holiday, places where we can live and prosper. Surveys show that 88% of Russians share Olga's view that Crimea joining Russia is to be welcomed, whatever the consequences. That may be due partly to the way Russian television has been covering the story, the triumphalist tone of news bulletins and the regular reports claiming that Russian speakers in Ukraine are facing persecution. Kiev dismisses that as propaganda. Outside her block of flats in Tchaikovskoye, I ask a pensioner, Galina, whether she thinks that everything Russian TV reports about Ukraine is true. Galina is completely taken aback by the question. What, are you suggesting they're distorting things, she asks. No, that can't be. Are you saying it's not all true? No, I believe our TV. Back at their rehearsal, the veterans' choir is singing about love and the eternal question to which there is no answer. What will the future bring? Singer Tatiana says she hopes it brings peace. Don't worry, Russia will never start a war, Tatiana says. My father spent the whole of World War II in the trenches. He was wet, he was freezing, he was starving. There isn't a single Russian who would want to return to that. But a new Cold War, well, that's more likely. And perhaps it's already begun. It's certainly a new era of discord between East and West.
That report from the BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Russia.
There was some big news last week that slipped through my news crack. And it concerns someone I've admired for years and yet surprisingly is not me. I'm talking about David Letterman, who last Thursday night announced his retirement. And I am going to miss this good man.
That, of course, is Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report last night on the day that it was announced that he is going to be replacing David Letterman as host of The Late Show. Just part of a string of changes in late night TV this year. Joining us now to talk about all of it is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here.
Well, and the big question that everyone has been asking, and you have been asked already today, is Stephen Colbert going to be Stephen Colbert of the Colbert Report, which it sounds like he's not. It's going to be the real Stephen Colbert that we don't really know that much about. Before we get your answer here, I want to play a clip of Colbert talking in character to Robert Siegel on All Things Considered back when he started the Colbert Report.
You know, I think it's pretty obvious the Daily Show is just a tool of the liberal elite. You know, we're gonna actually get into some truth and some issues that I think they're afraid to deal with.
So you're going to be the tougher end of the...
I just think John's been co-opted by the media. He's too much of a darling these days to really to stick it to the rest of the industry.
He's the most trusted man in broadcasting, they say.
Huh? So was Cronkite.
Yes.
I think I've made my point.
Eric, which Stephen Colbert are we going to see on The Late Show?
Well, if you believe what he's told the New York Times, we are going to see the real Stephen Colbert, the actual guy. But what's interesting is I've watched several clips now online of Colbert playing this fake conservative guy and Colbert being himself. And really, Colbert being himself is just he's a little more laid back. He's a little more less energetic and he doesn't crack as many jokes. That's the big difference. So I really think that when Stephen Colbert takes over The Late Show and is telling jokes and is energetic and is entertaining people, there's not going to be that much difference between the fake character that he played on The Colbert Report and the entertainer who's going to inhabit The Late Show.
And I know there have been some questions about whether the new Late Show is going to be in New York, where it is now, or in L.A., which just lost The Tonight Show to New York after many decades. Do we know any more about that?
We don't. We just have people making informed guesses, which is that neither CBS nor Colbert have indicated any desire for him to leave New York. Mm. It wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for them to move the show, particularly since Craig Ferguson, the guy who airs right after Colbert, is kind of a question mark. We don't really know if he's going to stay in that job at 12:30, and his show is in Los Angeles.
Okay, I'm glad you brought up Craig Ferguson, because what this leaves us with right now, depending on what happens with Craig Ferguson, is five shows in late night and all five hosted by white guys.
Imagine that. It's like I think the problem is that they are hiring hosts that look like their target audience in a way. They're trying to capture young males with these shows, and so they're hiring hosts who are just slightly older versions or in some cases a little older versions of the target audience they're trying to get to watch the show.
Why are they trying to go after young males?
There's a sense in the TV industry that daytime programming is the province of middle-aged women and late-night programming is the province of young males. It's odd. You know, young males are considered lucrative by the television industry because they don't watch a lot of television. So in a weird way, it's like a restaurant taking customers who come in the place every day and seating them next to the bathroom and treating the people who only come once a month to the best seat in the house. It's sort of a backwards way of doing things.
We're speaking with NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Eric, let's talk about some of the people that we are already seeing on Late Night, some of the new faces, and starting with Seth Meyers, who's taken over Late Night on NBC. Here he is in his previous role on Saturday Night Live.
Justin Bieber, who was arrested Thursday for drunk driving and drag racing, reportedly asked officers, "What did I do and why did you stop me?" Which will go down in history as the first sentence Bieber didn't begin and end with, "Girl."
And here he is on Late Night.
I was surprised by this. A court in Boston ruled that taking unsolicited upskirt photos of strangers does not violate Massachusetts Peeping Tom law. Hurrah! Shouted the creepy guy at work before he pretended it was a sneeze and left the room.
Eric, how is Seth Meyers doing? I have heard criticism that he's kind of sticking to what he knows, which is making jokes about the news.
In terms of ratings, he's doing just fine. He's beating his competition, which is primarily Craig Ferguson on CBS, and he is holding on to a good portion of the people who watch Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show, which is also doing very well. So by that yardstick, I'm sure NBC is very pleased. But as a critic, when I watch the show, I have a sense that he hasn't yet figured out a voice that's separate from the voice that he used when he was on Saturday Night Live. But as I said, he's doing well in the ratings, so I'm sure NBC is happy, but he's really going to have to find a voice that's different than what we saw him do on SNL.
Well, one late night host that is doing very much the same thing that he did in his previous incarnation is Jimmy Fallon, who has essentially taken Late Night and moved it to The Tonight Show at 11:30 Eastern Time. I say 11:30 Eastern Time, by the way, because I grew up in the Midwest where these shows start at 10:30. So I do want to give a nod to that. Some people get to see them a little earlier. Let's listen to Jimmy Fallon here doing a bit with Anne Hathaway.
Go, 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 shorty. It's your birthday. We're going to party like it's your birthday.
We're going to sip a Bacardi like it's your birthday. Birthday.
No, we don't. Not at all. Happy birthday.
You know, he's going with a lot of stuff that can go viral online. I almost wonder if Jimmy Fallon is playing to the audience online rather than the audience on TV.
Well, Jimmy Fallon and his competition, Jimmy Kimmel on ABC, have both had very strong online presences and have always used viral videos to stoke interest in their shows. And in fact, you know, I'm surprised that it's taken this long, but now we've reached a point where part of the way you measure the success of a late night show is by looking at how successful it is at generating viral video conversation in the social media sphere. And so that's one of the things people look at Stephen Colbert and they say, well, will he be able to do that? Because as great as the Colbert Report show was, it didn't have a strong viral presence outside of a few really special bits that he did that really made an impact. So it's been interesting to see media critics and people who watch this space suddenly take a look at, well, you know, how many viral videos is Fallon creating? How many viral videos is Kimmel creating? How many followers or subscribers do they have on their YouTube channels and things like that? Metrics that, of course, Johnny Carson and David Letterman and Jay Leno never really had to deal with.
Yeah.
But what happens is those videos are very good advertisements for the show, and they do also kind of tell people, if you want to know what people will be talking about tomorrow, if you want to see the video that people are going to be sharing the next day on Facebook and on Twitter, then maybe you should watch the show when it airs.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about all the shakeup in late night TV. Eric, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
BMW is recalling more than 156,000 luxury cars and SUVs because of possible stalling problems. This comes on the heels of Toyota's recall of more than 6.4 million cars this week. And then, of course, there are General Motors woes. The company has recalled 6.3 million vehicles since the beginning of this year. So are all these recalls happening by coincidence? Or are our cars less safe? Or are the companies just being more cautious? What is going on? Paul Eisenstein has been thinking a lot about this. He's the publisher of the car news website, thedetroitbureau.com, and he's with us from WDET in Detroit. Paul, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, what's behind the surge in all of these recalls?
Well, gee, you answered it all. Actually, you're correct. It is a little bit of everything. It is a matter of, in some cases, vehicles are having more problems because they're more complex. It is a little bit to do with the fact that manufacturers are being more cautious, especially as they face more pressure from the federal government and from us in the media. And it also has to do with the way that there are changes occurring in the way vehicles are being manufactured today, sharing parts that mean that when there's a problem, not just one, but many different models can be facing a recall.
Although it is a little like the boy who cried wolf. If you keep recalling things and you're being overly cautious, I wonder how many people actually bring their cars in and get them fixed.
Well, it's interesting that you said, because that is a very serious problem that the industry faces. Even with the most serious of safety issues, they generally find that only about 70, maybe 80% of people who are targeted for a recall will actually show up at the dealership to get a fix. In some cases, when it's a minor recall, they may only see 20 to 30% according to industry numbers.
Hmm. Okay, let's go through a couple of things you brought up there. First of all, are cars less safe?
In general, I would say no. If you look at almost all the supporting data, it suggests that vehicles are showing higher quality out of the box. They're showing better reliability after 3 to 5 years. And let's go to the most telling of numbers, which is the annual death toll on the highways. Compare it to a few years ago. More people are driving. They're driving further. They're driving higher speeds because, as you know, a lot of freeways have had their speed limits raised.
Right.
And yet the death toll is lowest in decades in terms of the raw number, about 33,000 last year. And on a per 100 million miles driven basis, it's also the lowest ever recorded. So from that sense, you would say vehicles are safer.
So what about the idea that they're now more complicated, that that's the reason for it, is that we've got everything's being run by a computer. If something goes wrong, it's just a lot more likely that there will be a recall.
Well, that is an issue because you do have much more complex vehicles, more things in a vehicle to go wrong. Manufacturers, I think, are making a good point of trying to catch problems when they occur. And generally, a recall is not – I'm sorry. Generally, a safety issue with a vehicle is not the reason that you have a crash or a fatality. The reality is most of the data suggests that 80% plus, maybe even as high as 95% plus of any fatalities are purely from driver error. So these problems are not the reason that we have most of our crashes on the road.
And Paul, just briefly, we've always heard of recalls as being part of the cost of doing business. You'd rather just bring things in and fix them than deal with the consequences later. Has that changed at all because of what's happened?
No, I think if anything, the manufacturers are getting more sensitive and more willing to do recalls as quickly as possible. I think the studies have shown that if you handle a recall well, a customer will actually be more loyal to a brand. Hmm. What it's all about is the ethics of the manufacturer.
Yeah.
If you do the thing right, customers will feel good. If you do things badly, well, what GM is facing right now, where you show that you might have risked the customer's safety
right
on a cost issue, then you're going to get punished.
Paul Eisenstein with the DetroitBureau.com. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
The violent clashes between Christians and Muslims in the Central African Republic have become so severe that the United UN Security Council voted yesterday to send in a nearly 12,000-member peacekeeping force. Thousands of people have been killed, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, and half the population now needs humanitarian aid. The fighting began about a year ago when Muslim rebels overthrew the national government. Now Christian groups are killing Muslim civilians in revenge and driving many others out of the country. Alexander Zavis is a reporter at the LA Times who recently spent 2 weeks in the Central African Republic, and she joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
And Alex, what's your sense of how much of a difference the UN peacekeeping troops can make? And we should note that they aren't even scheduled to arrive until September.
That's the key point. It's going to be months before they actually show up and can deploy around the country. There are currently about 2,000 French troops and nearly 6,000 African Union troops who are stretched very thinly across a huge area about the size of Texas. They've had a very hard time being where they need to be to stop the fighting. Things have gotten a little bit better. Some of the worst massacres that were taking place in December and January seem to have stopped, but there are reports of killings pretty much every single day. Just this week, at least 30 people were killed just north of the capital, Bangui, in an area that has no presence of either African or French peacekeepers at the moment.
Alex, you mentioned that one issue is that the troops already there are stretched thin. But I understand there's also an issue because the troops are largely Muslim, so the Christian population doesn't like that. So how is that a factor in how the troops on the ground may not be that effective now?
One contingent of the troops was coming from Chad, a country to the north, which is predominantly Muslim. And they had been implicated in various ways in this conflict going back many, many years. They actually supported the rebel groups that took over in March last year. They also were involved in the departure of the government that was set up by these rebels. But the Christian population saw them as defending Muslims who they accused of supporting a government that had been very brutal and had terrorized the country for many, many months. And they did not trust them. And those troops were accused of opening fire on civilians. They finally announced their departure, that they were pulling out a week ago. There are other troops who have come from Rwanda, from Burundi, from Congo. Those troops aren't predominantly Muslim, but they're often less trusted by the other side. So almost anybody who becomes involved gets seen as being partial. It's been a huge problem.
So is the idea that the UN troops will not only add volume, but maybe more neutral peacekeepers?
That is certainly the hope that's been expressed by a lot of people on all sides of this conflict. They also come in with more than just troops. They come in with all kinds of civilian experts who can help the transitional government that's been established try to assert its authority across the country. I mean, underlining the problems that you have now is that the government has completely collapsed. It never had much authority outside of the capital. At the moment, there are no functioning courts. There are no functioning prisons. There's a huge problem of impunity. Before you can really start addressing the grievances here, people keep saying they want justice, they want security, and they're not getting that from their own government. So the hope is that the UN, which is coming in with a much more robust force and with more than just a military component, but with police, with gendarmes, with these civilian experts, will actually be able to start helping them address the bigger issues that they need to address.
So as we said, you've actually been in the country. Tell us what it was like to be on the ground in the Central African Republic.
Pretty much every day that we were there, you were getting reports of attacks on one side or another. It was a very sort of tense situation. There were in the capital, in Bangui, you have many more peacekeepers there. You have international organizations there, particularly in the predominantly Christian areas. There were signs of life coming back, markets being open, a little bit of more confidence, but there were still huge numbers of people, even on the Christian side, who were living in camps for displaced people, too afraid to go back to their neighborhoods. And then you had these small pockets of Muslims who were completely surrounded by very hostile, predominantly Christian neighbors, were having grenades thrown into their areas at times, and were absolutely terrified and just desperately wanted to get out.
Did you witness any of this violence, or were you just getting reports of it?
While we were there, there was a huge attack that took place on the airport road. We weren't there as that happened. We came just afterwards and spoke to people about what had happened. And the people in the neighborhood were sort of describing it as the brave young men of the neighborhood had attacked, as they saw it, some Chadians, and had dragged them from the vehicle and started hacking them to death. Two of them died on the spot. Another one ran away. His body was found a few miles away and had been completely dismembered.
So very gruesome reports coming out of that country. And the way this conflict has been unfolding has been compared to the Rwanda genocide, which happened 20 years ago this week. Do you see those similarities?
Certainly, the levels of hatred and fear, there are some comparisons. And in the way that it has been sort of stirred up by political leaders, sort of for their own benefits. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan actually just said this week, the only reason it hasn't become a genocide is because so many Muslims have now left. So he's likened it to ethnic and religious cleansing. I mean, you have huge parts of the country, in the western side of the country, where the entire Muslim population has just packed up and fled, either out of the country altogether or to areas in the northeast of the country, which are dominated by this former Muslim rebel alliance that was in power briefly and that they see as their protectors.
Really? So the idea is that had they not left, it may have been a genocide, but there just aren't many Muslims left to kill.
That's right. Yeah, they estimate fewer than 1,000 left in Bangui, the capital itself, maybe 19,000 in the western half of the country. This is a population that once accounted for about 15% of the total population, which they estimated about 4.6 million.
Alex, based on your reporting, is this strictly a religious conflict, Christian versus Muslim, or are there other factors at play, whether political or economic or ethnic?
Everybody that we spoke to made the point that Christians and Muslims have lived together for decades. They've intermarried. They've used to celebrate holidays together. And there was a very strong sentiment that this was something that had been stirred up by political leaders. So people are now being killed because they are Muslim or because they are Christian. But that's not how it started out.
That's Alexandra Zavis of the LA Times. She's been reporting out of the Central African Republic. Alex, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Later this month is the 118th running of the Boston Marathon. And this year's race is especially significant because it's the first time it's been run since last year's bombing at the finish line. Because of that attack, two people will be taking part in this year's Boston Marathon who hadn't intended to be there, Dick and Rick Hoyt. For years, some spectators have come out just to see them, the compact, muscular man and his quadriplegic son, the father running while pushing a wheelchair all 26.2 miles. Team Hoyt, they're called, and they've been Boston Marathon stalwarts since 1981. But last year, after three decades of competing in the race, Dick and Rick Hoyt decided 2013 would be their last. They never made it to the end, though. They were among the almost 6,000 runners stopped on the course when the bombs went off. So Team Hoyt is running again. One last Boston Marathon, they told me, this time in honor of all the people killed and injured in last year's attack. How Dick and Rick Hoyt first competed together is now a beloved Massachusetts story. Rick has cerebral palsy, the aftermath of oxygen being cut off to his brain when he was born with an umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. Rick's mind is intact, but he can't speak or control his limbs. He did attend school, though, and one day he used his computerized voice to tell his dad about a charity road race. It was for a student lacrosse player who'd been badly injured in an accident.
When Rick came home, he told me all about it. He said, "Dad, I have to do something for him. I want to let him know life goes on, even though he's paralyzed. I want to run in the race."
At the time, Dick Hoyt was far from in top physical condition. His responsibilities as a husband and father of three boys didn't leave much time for exercise. He didn't want to say no to his son, though, so they entered the race.
Everybody thought that we would just go to the corner and turn around and come back. Well, we didn't. We finished the whole 5 miles coming in next to last, but not last. And when we got home that night, Rick wrote on his computer, "Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears."
For Rick, being on a race course, even though it was his father's legs doing the running, gave him the sense he was as able-bodied as all the other competitors.
He called himself Freebird because now he was free and able to be out there competing and running with everybody else. And he actually had a sign made up that said Freebird that he attached to his running chair.
The Hoyts knew they had to keep running. So they had a special racing wheelchair made for Rick, a streamlined three-wheeler that wouldn't keep veering off course. Then they began doing longer races, and eventually set their sights on the Boston Marathon. Race organizers turned them down at first, but finally relented, although the Hoyts got no special treatment.
They made us qualify in Rick's age group. And that was kind of tough, you know, because Rick was in his 20s, I was in my 40s, and they were using Rick's age for us to qualify. And that meant we had to run a 250.
Hard.
Hard, yeah.
But they qualified and ran Boston, and that was the beginning of a legendary father-son partnership. The Boston Marathon became an annual event for them. Then came triathlons and Ironmans. They use a specially designed tandem for their bike rides and a boat with a cord Dick pulls for their swims. Training got tricky when Rick went away to college at Boston University.
And so what I did is I replaced him with a bag of cement. And at the time, he weighed 95 pounds, and a bag of cement weighed 94 pounds, so it made sense. So I put a bag of cement in the running chair and in the bike, but you just see the looks of all these people, me riding downtown, carrying a bag of cement. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
They competed all over the world, and the more Dick and Rick raced publicly, the more they wanted the world to know that a physical disability doesn't have to be insurmountable. It hadn't been for Rick. That's even though doctors had said he'd be a lifelong vegetable, best put away in an institution, and even though some people thought Rick, with his flailing arms and legs, shouldn't even be out in public.
When Rick was born, you know, we'd take Rick in a restaurant, people would get up and leave, then they didn't want him in school, then they didn't want us competing. And our message is, yes, you can. There isn't anything you can't do as long as you make up your mind to do it. And there's no such word as no.
Team Hoyt didn't begin as a cause, but the Hoyts became, in a way, accidental crusaders. They started hearing from alcoholics, drug addicts, injured military veterans, struggling people who told the Hoyts they'd given them inspiration to try to turn their lives around.
And the biggest thing is that we got all these other kids that are physically challenged out in the public now, and they're able to live, learn, work, and play just like everybody else. We have been able to help change all of that.
They've done that through their Hoyt Foundation, which raises money for nonprofits that help disabled kids. Last year, though, the Hoyts paused to reassess. Dick is now 73. Rick, his kid, is now middle-aged. He's 52. And all the competing has taken its toll on Dick especially. He has carpal tunnel syndrome from the miles spent clutching a wheelchair. He had a heart attack a decade ago. His back constantly aches.
My body's starting to tell me, you know, after all these races and stuff, that it's time to cut back.
And a Sports Illustrated story 3 years ago suggested that Team Hoyt had been pushing too far for too long. The 2013 Boston Marathon, Dick and Rick decided, would be their last as a team. Their announcement made national headlines, and they were commemorated with a life-size bronze statue in Hopkinton to mark their final crossing of the starting line. On race day, April 15th, 2013, they almost finished.
We got to the 23-mile marker, and I noticed a lot more police activity. And so I stopped and talked to a police officer. I said, is there anything going on? And that's when he told me that two bombs had exploded at the finish line.
At that point, Dick Hoyt knew the marathon was over.
Did you know immediately this can't be our last marathon because of the attack?
Oh, yeah. Because, we didn't finish it, but the big thing was our concern was the people that would get killed and wounded, you know? And so that's why we're running this year, is for the people who get killed and wounded.
The Hoyts say their racing days won't be entirely over after this year's Boston. They still plan to do shorter runs together, and some Team Hoyt supporters want to help Rick keep competing in Boston by finding someone other than his dad to push him.
The Boston Marathon is the one event that I look forward to all year long.
This is Rick's computerized voice, the one that lets him express all the ideas and feelings teeming in his head that his mouth can't produce.
The people along the way are the best. When I hear them yell our names out, it gives me a great feeling inside.
Rick had arrived midway through my conversation with his dad, quietly rolling through a back door with the help of one of his personal care attendants. It's laborious for him to create new computerized speech, so instead, he played for me a recording he'd made.
Many people have asked me what I would do if I weren't disabled. I have thought long and hard about what I would do if I weren't in a wheelchair. Maybe I would play hockey, basketball, or baseball, but then I thought about it some more and realized that what I would probably do first is tell my dad to sit down in the wheelchair, and now I would push him.
That sound at the end was Rick smiling as he listened along. I asked Dick Hoyt about that, the idea of him in the chair, with Rick running behind. Wouldn't that be awesome, Dick said. But he told me Rick already pushes him now, with that big smile on his face as he rides past the waving, cheering crowds. A free bird, just like the sign on the wheelchair says. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art. New shows on view now by artists William Kentridge and Nick Cave, ICABoston.org.